Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me for the first time is my co-host, the light of my life, my wife, Maria McCoy.
Hi, it's nice to be on your show finally.
You probably noticed a difference in the recording quality. Instead of recording these separately, we are recording looking at each other here in our crowded little basement. And so I hope that it comes out okay in the end. So, Marina, you want to introduce yourself and say a little bit about what it is you do?
Hi, so I'm married to John. I'm the mother to his two children. I also have a career as a philosophy professor at Boston College. I am not a specialist in James Joyce or in any form of literature other than Plato, which I read more philosophically.
Okay, so we are doing this time, as you probably noticed when you downloaded this episode, we are doing James Joyce's Ulysses, which was originally published in its entirety in 1922. Previously on this podcast, John Syracuse and I talked about Dubliners. And for those of you keeping score at home, Joyce wrote Dubliners first and then wrote The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Ulysses is the next in this sequence of books that share characters. Dubliners only tangentially shares characters. There are characters that are mentioned by name in both Portrait of the Artist of the Young Man and Ulysses. But Ulysses does pick up where Portrait of the Artist left off in that it shares a major character, Stephen Dedalus, who is the basically James Joyce in a very perfunctory disguise. It's James Joyce, Stephen Dedalus. It was your suggestion that we read this book.
Yeah, so the reason we decided to read it is John and I are going away on a couple's vacation for 10 days in Ireland, leaving in a few days. And my thought was that we would have a more enjoyable experience of going to Dublin and other places around Ireland if we had read some literature and poetry. I'd never read Ulysses, but I'm a great fan of Homer's Odyssey, which I have read and reread many times. It's a book that's dear to my heart. So I thought, well, let's maybe read Ulysses together. So initially we decided that we were going to read the entire book of Ulysses out loud to one another in the evenings over a glass of wine. That worked for about the first half of the book, and then we realized we were coming up on our trip and we had not gotten further than halfway through. So we've done a little bit of independent reading. John's read the book before, I have not. I was told that the book takes 24 hours to read aloud. I think that is an exaggeration of how quickly one could read it, because I'm a fast talker, and I think it takes a little bit longer to read than 24 hours verbally. But anyway, we did do some reading aloud to one another. So our process was essentially that one of us would read three or four pages of Ulysses while the other person looked on to a copy of Ulysses Annotated, Notes for James Joyce's Ulysses by Don Gifford with Robert J. Seidman. And that book, that secondary book, provides explanations of the many allusions of what's happening in the original primary text to help us understand and comprehend things when they were fuzzy or unclear to us. And then we would switch roles and proceed from there.
And what did you think of that as a process? Did you find that enjoyable?
Yeah, I thought that was lots of fun. I kind of wish we'd read the whole book that way. But I really wanted to finish Ulysses before going to Ireland, because I think my prospects for a post-vacation reading of the rest of it are slim. So I wanted to read it before we got there. But how did you enjoy that process or not?
To back up just a little bit here, you mentioned that this is your first time reading the book. This is my second read through of the book. I read this in grad school, and that's why we have a copy of Ulysses Annotated, because my very wise professor told all of us, you're going to need this second book to understand the first book. So I had that on hand. Ulysses has a reputation of being an incredibly difficult and dense book. And reading it through again...
I wonder
again, why. Well, reading it through again, I'm struck both by how true that is and how, in some ways, it doesn't matter. It's sort of, once you get into the... Once you get into the swing of this book, you just are along for the ride, whether you know what's going on or not. You talked about us reading this. We did dutifully stick to this for a few weeks of reading, trying to read a chapter a night, although we would usually get about a halfway through a chapter. When I was in grad school, we read this book in, I think, 3 weeks. And that was the same semester I had to read two books by D.H. Lawrence. Two books by E.M. Forster. I wish I had the appetite for reading that I seem to have had back in my 20s.
It's interesting that you mentioned the process of reading and how it's very interesting to me. I'd always heard this is a difficult text. And so initially my thought in reading it was that we would read it very carefully and slowly and therefore get all or as many as possible of all the allusions. So for those of you who have maybe not read the text, it would not be uncommon to read something and then the annotated version find out that Joyce is making allusion to the well-known 1854 Irish ditty that was still perhaps being sung by people in his day in Dublin. But I think I found that the process of reading Ulysses over time became no longer a desire to try to have so much mastery and control over the process, kind of like I think that's what you're just saying, but more. So the book, I don't want to confuse things too much here, but the book obviously follows the Odyssey in certain respects. So different chapters are matched to different chapters in the Odyssey, which was exciting to see the connections to. But I was thinking just today, actually, as I was reading more of it, that there's a way in which our process of reading the text as readers is like going on an Odyssey. It's a journey for us. And the same way that Odysseus has things he can control and know and understand and master, and other things where he can't and he just has to be along for the ride, I have found reading Ulysses to be like that.
Ulysses is an enormous novel. And on the one hand, it's structurally incredibly complex because it plays back and forth between the contemporary story that's taking place in Dublin in 1904 on a specific day, on June 16th, which of course Joyce fans celebrate as Bloomsday every year. And so there's the contemporary story of what's happening with our heroes, Stephen Dedalus, who is a young scholar who teaches a boys' school and comes from an impoverished family. The portly and avuncular Leopold Bloom, who is the...
It'd be great if Harold Bloom made an appearance in this book.
Well,
that'd
Harold
be
Bloom.
Awesome.
Harold Bloom.
I bet he put it on his list.
This is actually his favorite book. I do know this is Harold Bloom's favorite.
Not book. Only because they share the same last name, you don't think?
I don't know, but I do know it is his favorite book. But I'm talking about Leopold Bloom, who is the stand-in for Odysseus, with Stephen being the stand-in for Telemachus. Leopold Bloom is a half Jewish, half Irish, now living in Dublin, seller of advertisements for the local newspaper, a kind of a silly, ridiculous character who is something of an outsider who observes all the comings and goings of Dublin life. And then his wife, Molly Bloom, who is also from outside of Dublin, who grew up in Spain, and is a amateur singer of some renown in Dublin, and who is also having an affair with her manager at the music hall, who stands in for Penelope. And each of them get it in turn to have the story focus on them roughly in the order that the story focuses on the characters of Telemachus, Odysseus, and Penelope in the Odyssey. But of course, it's also, aside from the allusions that are being made to Homer, there are frequent allusions to Hamlet in this book. There are allusions to biblical and other classical sources. And then there are, as you mentioned, all these allusions to popular culture of the late 19th, early 20th century in Ireland. And that's the part that loses mon readers. None of us are familiar with what were music hall hits of the mid-1800s. And there are also allusions to the Irish independence movement in the 19th and early 20th century. Now, you can either decide you're going to take it upon yourself to understand every single passage of this book and go through it with a concordance and stop every sentence, or you can do that for a bit and give up after a while.
Which we did. You know, I think we did kind of approach the text that way in the beginning, which was fun and interesting and scholarly. But I think it was actually better when we didn't do that and would still sometimes like look through the annotated guide. But I definitely found that something about embracing the experience of just like going along with the text and then having these wonderful aha moments where I would recognize connections. So for example, so we haven't finished the whole book yet, but at this point I've read through the chapter that corresponds to Nausicaa and to the chapter that corresponds to the oxen that belong to Zeus. And it's delightful to make connections back to the Odyssey, which is a text I know much better. So when those connections are made, it's a really wonderful experience. But I think I've had to kind of give up on the idea that I always know what's happening at all times. And I think that's part of, you know, Joyce's project in writing this, is that he doesn't necessarily, he wants it to be a place where you can continually go back. And there's a kind of mystery that's involved in reading it, that there's a impenetrability of, you know, in some ways, even so like Leopold Bloom, who is so straightforward, he's extremely amusing to me, you know, like, I do not think like Leopold Bloom or like Stephen Dedalus. I mean, I think the contrast between those two characters, where Stephen Dedalus is like so in his head all the time and constantly thinking about literature and Latin and particular moments. I mean, I know Aristotle, and he's thinking about potentiality and actuality in Aristotle as he's walking along the beach. And one wonders if he actually sees the rocks or the sky or the sand on the one hand. And then there's Leopold Bloom, who reminds me of like a highly distractible. He sees something, he thinks something about it, it leads him to another thought, and to another thought, and to another thought. And both of those ways of thinking are kind of foreign to me.
This is a book about interior thought. It's a book where all the characters are thinking it all the time. And they are thinking deep thoughts, they are thinking ridiculous thoughts, they are thinking grossly sexual thoughts or thoughts of appetite. And Bloom is at the center of this world as a perpetual outsider, as someone who is largely rejected by the other characters in this book for being Jewish and for being a slightly ridiculous man. He is nonetheless cheerful and engaged and interested in everything that he sees. And he sees all of Dublin's life in this morning that seems to be spent wandering to and fro with no particular direction in mind. The characters eventually attend the funeral of one Paddy Dignam, who was known by Stephen's father. There's a scene where all the newspaper editors get together and talk about the current state of Irish independence as Bloom tries to sell them on another ad. There's a scene that takes place in the National Library where Stephen excitedly tries to explain to everyone why Hamlet was actually based upon a passage in Shakespeare's life where Shakespeare's wife was unfaithful to him. and he doesn't get a lot of traction from his audience. But by and large, people just kind of wander around Dublin a lot in this book, and they wander into pubs a lot. There's a lot of drinking in this book, like two or three scenes where people walk into pubs in the middle of the day, and as night comes on, they wander into the red light district and drink more there.
I mean, I do think the theme of wandering is part of what constitutes the quality of the book as being Odyssean, right? This sense that there's a kind of wandering, but it's also very, there's a lot of purpose to what Bloom is doing. I mean, he knows kind of where he's going. It's a town he has a lot of links to. I mean, he's both an outsider and an insider. It's interesting. I had not thought about this at all before, but there's a point in the book where he gets harassed at a bar by a character that's called the Citizen, who represents, I guess, a particular character from our Irish history. And this person is extremely anti-Semitic and harasses Bloom, and Bloom barely gets away with his life. And there's a moment at which one of the other characters defends Bloom and says, there are all these people who are Jewish, and Christ himself was a Jew. And as you were talking, I was thinking, like, you know, there are, you know, it's interesting. Bloom is like Odysseus, but he's also like Christ in a certain way. Like, that incident reminds me of the passage in the Gospels in which Jesus comes to preach the good news. I mean, Leopold Bloom is certainly not like a highly saintly, perfect man or anything, but there's a point where Jesus comes to preach the good news to Nazareth, and he's rejected in his own hometown, and he barely escapes as they're throwing rocks at him. And there's such strong parallels. Probably the annotated guide says this somewhere, but strong parallels to when Jesus is having attacks made against him, and he just barely escapes with his own life. So I think there are interesting ways in which you could kind of look at Bloom as, on the one hand, he's Jewish, he suffers for the anti-Semitism that Joyce does not shy away from displaying as common enough, I suppose, in his time. Bloom, I think, in a strange way, kind of represents Christ. It's interesting because there are many places where in the text he says something and he just slightly misunderstands, like, how the Catholic Church does something, or he, like, slightly misquotes something, or he slightly doesn't get something that's going on at Mass. But in some ways, it's all the other people around him that don't really get what's going on, the people who are supposedly the true Catholics, who are then anti-Semitic, who don't get the essence of what it is to love as a Christian. And it's Bloom who, in his simplicity and his ordinariness and in his just walking the streets and just trying to do the best he can in the moment, is a different kind of model, maybe, than the more pretentious people who have these high-minded ideas of what they ought to be.
Something you said early on about Bloom's wandering as being purposeful is an interesting point to make, because the book starts with Bloom, or the book actually starts with Stephen, but the part of the book that starts with Bloom has Bloom going out on morning errands and leaving Molly to rest at home in bed. And Molly will spend most of this book basically lounging around while Bloom goes out into the world. So as readers, we're left to make this funny comparison between Bloom's wanderings and Odysseus's wanderings. Odysseus, of course, was thrown off course in the time after the Trojan War. He'd spent 10 years at war and then got blown off course for 10 years afterwards by angering the gods. Bloom is just going out down to a stroll to the butcher's and to pick up some soap for Molly. But what's amazing about the way that allusion works in this book is it's double-edged. On the one hand, it elevates highly mundane activities by giving them this classical reference. On the other hand, it makes them kind of silly, because there is something grandiose and ridiculous about these comparisons. But you keep getting both at the same time, I think, throughout the book.
Yeah, so here's an example of that. So let me read some Stephen Dedalus character and some Leopold Bloom characters. Stephen Dedalus says things like this. Ineluctable modality of the visible, at least that, if no more, thought through my eyes. Signatures of all things I am here to read, sea spawn and sea wreck, the nearing tide, that rusty boot, snot green, blue silver, rust colored signs, limits of the diaphane. But he adds, and bodies. Then he was aware of them bodies, before of them colored. How? By knocking his sconce against them, sure, go easy. Bald he was and a millionaire, maestro di color che sana. Limit of the diaphane in, why? In diaphane, a diaphane. If you can put your five fingers through it, it is a gate. If not, a door. Shut your eyes and see. Stephen closed his eyes to hear his boots crush, crackling, rack and shells. You are walking through it. Howsomever, I am a stride at a time, a short space of time through very short time of space. 5, 6, the Nikanander. So, I mean, here's Stephen supposedly paying attention to the activity of walking through shells on a beach, but it's so incredibly mediated by these concepts of the education he's received that I find him to be a character who's very much living in his head and mediating everything he experiences through concepts. Contrast this to Leopold Bloom, who also has this moment where he actually seems to refer to Heraclitus. Here he is walking through. He halted again and bought from the old apple woman 2 Banbury cakes for a penny, and broke the brittle paste and threw its fragments down into Liffey. See that? The gulls swooped silently too, all of them from their heights, pouncing on prey, gone every morsel. Aware of their greed and cunning, he shook the powdery crumb from his hands. They never expected that. Manna. Live on fishy flesh, they have to. All seabirds, gulls, sea goose, swans from Anna Liffey swim down here sometimes to preen themselves. No accounting for tastes. I wonder what kind is swan meat. Robin Crusoe had to live on them. Good idea, that. I wonder if he pays rent to the corporation. How can you own water, really? It's always flowing in. A stream, never the same, which in the stream of life we trace. Because life is a stream. All kinds of places are good for ads. That crack doctor for the clap used to be stuck up in all the greenhouses. You never see it now. Strictly confidential. Okay. That, to me, is like a crazily good portrayal of Leopold Bloom. On the one hand, the man is just like moving from thought to thought to thought. He's like, here are some seagulls. Look at that. They eat every morsel of what I throw them. He makes this seeming allusion to Heraclitus that water's always flowing in a stream. It's never the same. That line seems to be a lot like Joyce, this idea that there's a sort of stream of consciousness approach he takes to prose. And then suddenly we break into this idea about the doctor for the clap that used to get stuck up in all the greenhouses. So I think there's a way in which Bloom, on the one hand, is kind of heroic because he's more present to his world than Stephen Dedalus. He's less mediating the world than Dedalus, who's like so in his head that he doesn't really experience the day-to-day of life. Bloom actually sees the seagulls. He sees the morsels that he's throwing to them. He's embodied. He's present. He's incarnate. In that sense, he's Christ-like because he's fully incarnate. At the same time, there's this humorous aspect of him where he just moves from the most elevated thoughts about how life is like a stream to talking about the clap. And I think that really captures who Bloom is. This guy who's just moves from thought to thought to thought to moment to moment to moment to moment. And in a sense, we can't capture whether he's the hero who gets it all in a way that nobody else does, or the most mundane, crass, ordinary man who doesn't have a grasp on what life is about, but it's just kind of moving from sensual moment to sensual moment.
I can't help but feel that, as you say, Bloom represents a different mode of thought, and he represents, in some way, through the course of this book, he takes on a friendly parental role to Stephen, in some ways to mirror what happens, to mirror the story of the Odyssey, where Telemachus is actually Odysseus' son. But it's also because this is a book that is very much about art and forms. If you go back and listen to the podcast on the dead, you recall that John Syracuse and I talked a little bit about Joyce's preoccupation with what is a modern mode of writing, and what and how does that modern mode of writing relate to being authentically Irish. And I think that this book is an interesting book because, on the one hand, it stands as this pinnacle of modernism, which typically means stream of consciousness, interiority, an emphasis upon mundane life as lived. On the other hand, all of its references are classical and grand and sweeping, and they appeal to a educated reader, as one would be who had a classical education in Europe. At any time after the Renaissance, you were expected to know most of the allusions that are made in this book. So there's this tension between the old and the new in this book, and there's also, I think, a strong tension between the specifics of Dublin and Joyce's designs for writing a modernist work that transcends place. To get a little bit extra textual, Joyce wrote most of this in Zurich and in Paris. He didn't write this while living in Dublin. I also know that Bloom was based upon a good friend of his, who was this half-Jewish, half-Italian guy. What was his name? I'll look it up here. He was based upon Aaron Eteor Schmitz, who was also a writer that Joyce was very fond of. So I wonder to what extent Bloom is supposed to represent that sort of style, that new style, that modern style, because Bloom does represent the successful depiction of stream of consciousness. In some ways, Stephen is also stream of consciousness, but it's a consciousness that's completely mired in its own thoughts.
I think they're all kind of stream of consciousness, though. So the Nausicaa character, Gertie, who's in the chapter that corresponds to Nausicaa, which, by the way, I was very excited to connect to Nausicaa because in the Odyssey, when Odysseus is on his travels, he has this time where he lands on the island of the Phaiakians, and he arrives on the island. His ship has been destroyed, and he has swum through waters such that his clothing has been torn off his body. He arrives naked on shore, and this young maiden Nausicaa sees him, and the gods make Odysseus super attractive, even though he's all covered with brine and all dirty and all over. And so she sees him, and he's, you know, been like made particularly beautiful by the gods. And so she's full of this young woman's desire, and it's made a point that she's at a age suitable for marriage, and she sees him and wants to bring him back to home. And there's lots of hints in the book that she would love to marry this guy. And by the way, it turns out that she's been on the beach with her maiden friends, her servants, I guess, or other women who are now the princesses, doing her laundry. And so because he doesn't have clothes on, she, in the Odyssey, Nausicaa puts some of her clothes onto Odysseus so he's not naked to go back to this town. But the parents are obviously rather concerned when their daughter shows up with this man who's wearing their daughter's clothes that they recognize that she's been doing the laundry. So they wonder what's happened. And there's a lot of testing that goes on back and forth. And in my understanding of Homer's Odyssey, there's a question as to whether Odysseus has to make a choice about whether to go back to Penelope, having missed out on 20 years of marriage to a woman who's aged, when he's aged, to go back to being a mortal, to having to accept the limits of 20 years apart that can never be recaptured, or this option to maybe start over with Nausicaa, who becomes a kind of proto-Penelope, someone where he could pretend as though time had not passed, and he could begin again and not miss out on all those years by just choosing a different woman. But it's interesting, Joyce's version of this is this young woman, Gertie, who's watching little kids, who basically shows off her stockings and underwear underneath her skirt to Leopold Bloom, who then has this sexual kind of escapade watching her. And their understandings subjectively are so utterly different, it kind of made me laugh. There is a stream of consciousness to both these characters, but what that looks like is so different, and I found it very funny. So here's Gertie talking about her encounter with looking at this man. She was glad that something told her to put on the transparent stockings, thinking Reggie Wiley might be out, but that was far away. Here was that of which she had so often dreamed. It was he who mattered. There was joy on her face because she wanted him, because she felt instinctively he was like no one else. The very heart of the girl woman went out to him, her dream husband, because she knew on the instant it was him. If he had suffered, more sinned against than sinning, or even if he had himself been a sinner, a wicked man, she cared not. Even if he was a Protestant or a Methodist, she could convert him easily if he truly loved her. There were wounds that wanted healing with heart balm. She was a womanly woman, not like other flighty girls, unfeminine, he had known, those cyclists showing off what they hadn't got, and she just yearned to know all, to forgive all, if she could make him fall in love with her, make him forget the memory of the past. Then mayhap he would embrace her gently, like a real man, crushing her soft body to him, and love her, his ownest girlie, for herself alone. Refuge of sinners, comfortress of the afflicted, ora pro nobis. Okay, that's Gertie's voice. Highly romantic, young, girlish, sweet, you know, different than any of the characters we've encountered so far, and very like Nausicaa in that sense. And then Bloom essentially she exposes herself to him somewhat, and ends up, you know, masturbating and having sexual response to her. In his account of what happens is completely and utterly different. So she's waved her hanky at him as a sign that he can come back tomorrow if he wants some more, so his version of being Odysseus is he wonders, should I come back or not tomorrow to do this again? And he basically decides against it, I think, that it's not really repeatable. So she's walking away, and it turns out she's limping. Tight boots? No, she's lame. Mr. Bloom watched her as she limped away. Poor girl. That's why she's left on the shelf, and the others did a sprint. I thought something was wrong by the cut of her jib. Jilted beauty. A defect is 10 times worse than a woman, but it makes them polite. I'm glad I didn't know when she was on show. Hot little devil all the same. Wouldn't mind. Curiosity, like a nun or a negress or a girl with glasses. The squinty one's delicate. Near her monthlies, I expect. It makes them feel ticklish. I have such a bad headache today. Where'd I put the letter? All right. All kinds of crazy longings, licking pennies, gruel and tranquilla convent that nun told me liked to smell rock oil. Virgins go mad in the end, I suppose. Sister, how many women in Dublin have it today? Martha, she. Something in the air. It's the moon. Why don't all women menstruate at the same time with the same moon? I guess it depends on the time they were born, I suppose. Or I'll start scratch, then get out of step. I mean, so the version of what just happened between these two people is utterly different between Gertie and Leopold Bloom. And I think the thing that's interesting about Joyce is that somehow he's kind to both of his characters, even though I think we're asked to laugh at them a little bit and to sort of, and to see how partial and perspectival their own view of what's happened is.
The Nausicaa passage from Ulysses is, for anyone who hasn't read the book, you probably are aware of the fact that this book was banned in this country at one point, and there was a large obscenity case. And so that was it there, guys. That was what all the fuss was about.
I didn't read that part, though.
Right. Well,
I didn't read the part.
Right. No, but that chapter was. I think that we are invited to have a charitable view of nearly everyone in this book. I think there are a few characters who are presented as ridiculous on their face.
And like the citizen is not well loved.
No. And interestingly enough, the citizen is a character who is strongly nationalist. And why I say that's interesting enough is because throughout this book, there are many discussions about Irish character and Irish nationalism. And that, I think, relates again to Joyce's explorations of, as an author, how much is he a writer for the world and how much is he a chronicler of this specific corner of the world. There are a lot of people in this book talking about these issues. In fact, early on, Stephen Dedalus rooms with an English student named Haynes, who is staying with Buck Mulligan and Steve Dedalus at the beginning of the book, who is very interested in Irish folklore and who opines that Irish people should all be speaking in Gaelic. I think that it's interesting that the citizen is presented as somewhat ridiculous.
You know, it's interesting because I think Joyce is obviously speaking out of a great love of Ireland. In fact, there's a point in the book where the claim is made that there hasn't been any great Irish author the way that Shakespeare wrote for the English and various authors have written for other cultures. And it's very clear that this is Joyce speaking at that moment out of the text and sort of saying, this is what I'm trying to do. But I think he has a love for Ireland that's different than the citizens, because the citizen is extremely narrow and prescriptive about what constitutes Irish identity. I'm not Irish. I have no connection to Irish. My family's a Latvian. But I'm speaking as an outsider, not as maybe an Irish person might speak about the text. But I think the citizen's problem is that he's so prescriptive about what he thinks is authentically Irish that he ends up excluding a lot that is actually Irish. Leopold Bloom is Irish, you know? There are many people and many approaches to what the Irish is. And I think the wonderful thing about Joyce is that through his walk through the physical habitation of Dublin and the process of meeting all these different people, you get to see this is all Ireland, this is all Irish. And the citizen has this a kind of broken view of trying to make Ireland purified or something of its embodied, rich, diverse character. And Bloom, who's supposed to be not Irish in a certain sense, right, because he's Jewish and somehow he's outside, he does see it because he's the guy that we see walk through Ireland and see and actually sees what's happening, although in the stream of consciousness, some sort of consciousness and sort of amusing.
And later, when we get to Molly, we also get this interesting amalgam of Irish and non-Irish in a character whose name is probably the most Irish name of them all, Molly. It's also worth pointing out that Stephen Dedalus in his studies is obsessed with Hamlet, that most quintessentially English playwright writing about Denmark, I guess. I think, however, we should probably stop here because we are going to pick up again after we finish the book and then maybe even have something to say after we've been to Ireland, right?
Yeah, so I think the thought process that we had was that it would be fun to do a podcast where We read a good portion of Ulysses, talked about it, went back and read a little bit more. So we have a couple more chapters yet to do. Go to Ireland. Does it make a difference to have gone to Ireland and how we understand the text of the Ulysses? And conversely, does having read Ulysses inform how we think about Dublin or Ireland? Yeah, I'm pretty excited about our trip, which is in a few days. And I'm pretty excited about finishing Ulysses before we go.
So welcome back. You may notice a difference in the recording quality because we have in the, what, 3 or 4 weeks since we recorded that last segment, we have traveled to Ireland and come back.
Yeah, we did. And I thought it would be fun for this segment of the podcast for me to interview John since he's always the one interviewing. So I thought that would be all right. How does that sound to you?
It's fine with me. Go ahead.
All right. Well, so the first question I have for you is we finished up all of Ulysses before actually heading off to Ireland. What was your experience of reading the book like compared to the first time that you read it? For me, it was a first reading, but for you, this is a reading that takes place how many years after the last time you read it?
Well, I read this in grad school probably in 94, I think. So it's been 24 years. I mean, this is...
So it's been a little while.
It's been a while, yes.
Time flies, though.
Right. Well, I would say, first of all, as I think I mentioned it before, I forgive us because we're going to forget a lot of things we said that you will have just heard, listeners, 20 minutes ago. But for us, it's a month. I remember that in grad school, we read this book in the course of, I think, about 3 weeks of class time. So on the one hand, I feel like I was a much faster reader when I was younger. On the other hand, I'm the only one making myself read this book this time, so I could enjoy it more, I think, in that way. I'll say this. There were passages in this book that I didn't like as much reading them the first time because we were in a class and we were hurried for time. The penultimate chapter of this book, which was Joyce's favorite, is a chapter in which Bloom and Stephen come back to Bloom's place after Bloom has helped Stephen out of a bar fight, basically, and they come home in the night and they urinate on the wall outside. Bloom offers for Stephen to stay over the night and Stephen says no. And very little happens in a way, but just a beautifully written chapter because it's written as a series of questions between the third person narrator and himself. It's sort of like a deposition almost. The questions are asked and answered, and it runs between the mundane events of what's happening and this cosmic view of the entire universe. And I remember when I was in grad school, I had no time for that because it was the end of a very long semester of reading, and I was really eager to get done with this book. This time, it felt like a luxurious experience to read that chapter.
Well, maybe 20-some years of academia has utterly ruined me for normal life, but I love the chapter also, and it was also my favorite chapter of the book. It was interesting because I had not read the book before, and I'd always heard that the final chapter of Molly's was the most compelling, interesting, controversial chapter, but I found it fine. I found it interesting. It was interesting to finally hear who Molly is after only seeing her through Bloom's eyes, but I didn't find it, you know, as compelling, I guess, as I expected it to be, maybe because the buildup was so high. But I have a passage that reflects for our readers some of what you were just talking about moving from the mundane to the universal. And that is precisely what I liked about this chapter. So one question that's asked in the course of this lengthy description Q&A about Stephen and Leopold Bloom spending time together is what's on the kitchen range. So, question. What did Bloom see on the range? On the right, smaller hob, a blue enameled saucepan. On the left, larger hob, a black iron kettle. What did Bloom do at the range? He removed the saucepan to the left hob, rose and carried the iron kettle to the sink in order to tap the current by turning the faucet to let it flow. Did it flow? Yes.
From Roundwood Reservoir in County Wicklow, of a cubic capacity of 2,400 million gallons, percolating through a subterranean aqueduct of filter means of single and double pipage, constructed at an initial plant cost of £5 per linear yard by way of Dargle, Rathdown, Glen of the Downs, and Callowhill, to the 26-acre reservoir at Stillorgan. What in water did Bloom, water lover, drawer of water, water carrier, returning to the range, admire? Its universality, its democratic equality and constancy to its nature in seeking its own level, its vastness in the ocean of marketer's projection, its unplumbed profundity in the sundom trench of the Pacific exceeding 8,000 fathoms, the restlessness of its waves and surface particles visiting in turn all points of its seaboard. What do you think the effect is of the question-answering mode there? I think it is a compelling way to have written a chapter, particularly in that no other chapter is written in this manner.
You're the Plato scholar. It reminds me most closely of a dialectic approach to discourse. Of course, throughout this book, Joyce is playing with form, and it's interesting that he chooses this moment to break into, in some ways, I think, his most philosophical mode in the work, because it is the chapter in which the least happens from the standpoint of plot, but it is the absolute crux of the novel, I think, in terms of developing the themes of the avuncular Bloom, the lost Stephen, this momentary connection of people. Bloom makes this offer to the drunk Stephen, stay over. Stephen says no, and in some ways the book leaves it as though it's doubtful their paths may ever cross again, but it's held up as such a centerpiece, not just because it's important to connect to the Odysseus story, but because it is about people connecting in a book where in some ways they haven't connected throughout the course of the book. People have been wandering to and fro, people have been talking, but both Stephen and Leopold have been outside observers to their own lives. Your question was about the form here. I mean, it's just a very enjoyable thing to read. It's very clever. It's hard to give in this summary a good understanding of the cleverness of what's going on here, because the narrator is asking questions that sometimes make sense. Sometimes they're questions that nobody would ever ask.
Yeah.
And it's inviting us to keep peering deeper and deeper into this moment. And the book as a whole has been an invitation for us to most mundane aspects of these people's lives and to look closer and closer at what's happening in the streets of Dublin. We mentioned before, it has 24 sections and they're supposed to be 1 hour each in the day. You're never going to read this book in 24 hours, even if you drink a gallon of coffee and make it through.
So we didn't make it through reading it aloud. What happened was when Dublin was not too far away on our trip, I suddenly was like, oh, we have 300 pages a lot to read aloud. And I calculated that we'd have to do quite a bit of reading. Maybe not 300. It was something like reading 40 pages aloud a night, which seemed not plausible. We ended up doing a lot of private reading, a little bit of public reading to one another. Yeah, I think Joyce is incredibly playful in that chapter. I liked his playfulness in the book in general. Maybe in a minute we can think about another spot that's the case. I think the thing I did like about the question and answer also is that it provides a kind of outside narrator point of view, but where the narrator is very playful in looking at their situation. It's kind of an omniscient narrator brought to an extreme. The narrator, like, for example, follows the path of water that leads to Leopold Bloom's house, or analyzes anagrams that are possible from certain names and so on. I found it a kind of touching chapter also, though, because a very human chapter, because Stephen and Leopold Bloom, Stephen Dedalus and Leopold Bloom both connect and they don't connect. in some ways, they connect really deeply in the way they talk with one another, and it's a kind of very tender thing. But there are moments, for example, where Bloom invites him to stay, and he decides not to. Leopold Bloom is subject to hearing about this anti-Semitic ditty that they discuss, which on the one hand reflects a kind of honesty between them about their relationship and how religion and class and, well, not class, because Stephen himself comes from a working class family, but how their different situatedness in the city informs how they're going to meet together. But I think there was a way in which, there's a line here where it talks about how each of them speaks, Stephen in Gaelic and Bloom in Hebrew, where there's a translation of text by guest to host and host to guest. And there was something really important about the way in which Bloom is hosting Stephen. He's the one who's offering the hospitality. He's the one who's inviting Stephen into his home, who is the guest there, that we see something about what it really means for someone to encounter a person in their otherness, where that otherness is preserved in their meeting together. So I don't have anything interesting to say about Molly other than he has a very long, interesting stream of consciousness. I found myself both liking and not liking Molly in that chapter. You know, like, mm-hmm. her relationships with other women seemed very charged and dismissive and competitive in ways that I found not right. very palatable. At the same time, I know it was an important work in James Joyce's own time for maybe entering into psychological spaces that weren't normally entered into in a literary sense. I did like it, but I found it maybe not my favorite chapter. What was your response to reading it both this time and last time?
I said when I did the Dubliners episode of this podcast with John Syracuse, I mentioned that The Dead in some ways is like a miniature version of Ulysses. The Dead also ends with people falling asleep and with the imagination on the verge of sleep becoming more expansive. Mm. In that case, it was Gabriel reacting to his wife Greta's story of a young lover and imagining that young lover. Interestingly enough, the story at the end of The Dead, the omniscient narration that Gabriel takes on moves from the urban center of Dublin off to the old city of Galway where Greta was born. And we also traveled from Dublin to Galway. Even today, there's a very strong difference between Dublin, which is an extremely urban center, and Galway, which maintains so much of its medieval character. I do have a soft spot in my heart for depictions of people falling asleep. In some ways, it's a kind of a cliche in writing, but when it's done well, it's beautiful. And in the case of Molly's soliloquy, her mind is drifting from all the events of the day and then on into memories of childhood, drifting from her feelings of dissatisfaction with her marriage to Bloom, memories of her recent sexual tryst with Blazes Boyland, and then it ends on this wonderful memory of Bloom's proposal, which is probably the most famous passage from the book.
Which I did like, by the way. Because all your listeners hate me.
Which is a very, it's just this beautiful affirmation of, Molly keeps repeating yes and yes and yes throughout this chapter.
And Rhonda, with the old windows of the Posada's glancing eyes, a lattice hid for her lover to kiss the iron, and the wine shops half open at night, and the castanets, the watchman going about serene with his lamp, and oh, that awful deep down torrent, oh, and the sea crimson, sometimes like fire, and the glorious sunsets, and the fig trees in the Alameda gardens, yes, and all the queer little streets and pink and blue and yellow houses, and the rose gardens, and the jessamine and geraniums and cactuses and Gibraltar as a girl, where I was a flower of the mountain, yes, when I put the rose in my hair, like the Andalusian girls used, or shall I wear a red, yes, and how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, and I thought well as well him as another, and then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes, and then he asked me, would I say yes, to say yes, my mountain flower, And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breaths all perfume, yes. And his heart was going like mad. And yes, I said, yes, I will, yes.
It's a beautiful passage that gets adapted a lot into other things. Listeners to the Wuthering Heights episode will know that I'm a huge Kate Bush fan. And Kate Bush did a song that was an adaptation of this last passage of Molly's. But when she wrote it, the Ulysses was still under copyright. And the estate of Joyce is notoriously litigious. And
that was like when we were in college, because we had that album, Hounds of Love, right?
It wasn't Hounds of Love. It was the Sensual World, and which was actually after we were in college. It was in
and the Joyce Estate still was
under cover. They still have that cover. Wow. But very recently...
I guess it's been a while since we've been in college.
Yes. But very recently, the Ulysses has passed into public domain, and Kate Bush was able to re-release the song in its original form, which is called Flower of the Mountain. And anyone who wants to... I of course, cannot play that on this podcast because I have no licensing rights. But there's nothing to prevent
you... Can you put in, like, a really short clip by law? Like three notes?
I have a better solution. Everyone go out there, get yourself a copy of Flower of the Mountain, or go to YouTube and find it there. And you can play that in the background while we continue to discuss this.
Yeah. Okay, so... Hit pause on your listening device. Go get the music that John recommended. And when you're ready, come back and rejoin us. So I actually thought that was a very beautiful ending to the book. And the other thing I did like about that chapter is it is the Penelope chapter. And it is supposed to be like the last two chapters, actually, or more like a reunion of Odysseus and Penelope. One of the things that I love about the end of the Odyssey is that when Odysseus comes home and after he's slaughtered the suitors and the blood has been cleaned up and he and Penelope reunite, they get into their bed that's made from the root of this tree that has like grown out of the ground and then been, you know, converted into a bed. It's not a bed that was moved into the house. The house is built around the bed. And they spend time there just talking to one another and catching up on what has happened in the past 20 years. And time slows down. And one of the beautiful things I like about that is that the gods slow time down so that Penelope and Odysseus can spend this time together. And I think that Joyce actually very effectively conveys that sort of temporal motion of, you know, here they are reuniting and it's not really clear what's past, what story, what's present, how long this takes place. But there is a way in which time is kind of pulled out and extended, not to eternity, of course, but in a way that somehow suggests that there's something being touched there. So, yeah, I found that a very beautiful aspect of the chapter and an interesting way in which they connect. We traveled to Ireland. We spent 10 days there, including travel days. Spent a few days in Dublin, and then we moved on to Dingle Peninsula. We went up to Galway, out to the Aran Islands, and then returned to Dublin. So we were in Dublin at the beginning and the end of our trip. The one thing I wanted to ask you was, what was it like for you to be in the city of Dublin after having read the book? And with, you know, I guess thinking about the book being very recently on our minds as we walked around the city.
Well, famously in Dublin, on June 16th, they do the Bloomsday Walk, where people actually follow the path of where Bloom and Stephen walked through the course of the book. We didn't do that. What we did do is we walked a lot around the city center, especially in up and down O'Connell Street, and then to what's the place where all the famous bars, the pubs are?
Temple Bar area.
Temple Bar area.
But it has a place.
So, and that section, that's a very touristy part of town. But the reason it is touristy is that's the part that still has all the 18th and 19th century buildings. And so those were, a lot of those buildings were there when Joyce lived in Dublin. And those were what he was writing about. And what I found fascinating as we walked around the space, two things. One was, it occurred to me that Ulysses is a book about
wandering. It's a book about walking through a city. And I was impressed as we walked through Dublin by how much it is still a completely pedestrian city.
Very walkable.
Very walkable. There is traffic that goes through it, but that central part of town, the car traffic makes up very little of what's happening. And even the bus traffic makes up more. But even that is dwarfed by the number of people who are just walking around the place at all hours of the day. It's a very crowded city street, but it's a comfortable crowded. People are very congenial. People are very friendly. People look out for each other. And it was heartening to see that aspect of what was described in the book was still true in Dublin today. But the other thing that was fascinating to me was just the number of places in Dublin that made reference to Joyce and specifically to Ulysses. Just around the corner from the hotel where we stayed, there was a street sculpture of Joyce that we got our pictures taken by.
We should put that on the Sophomore Lit webpage.
Yeah, if I can find it,
I have it.
Okay, we'll put it up. Yeah. And if you turn the other direction, you went up to the Dublin Writers Museum, which had an enormous wealth of information on Joyce as well as many other Dublin authors. And when you walk through the Temple Bar area, you come across the Bloom Hotel, which had on its facade on each side these enormous murals in the style of Alphonse Mucha depicting Leopold Bloom, Molly Bloom, and Stephen Dedalus. And it just fascinates me that a book that is so dense and it has a reputation, at least in the States, of being impenetrable, is part and parcel of the life of Dublin.
We went to the Irish Writers Museum as well, and I certainly felt like all throughout Dublin there was a real sense of the literary, a sense of a literary history with a wide variety of authors. Of course, not only Joyce, but others, Yeats and Shaw and... basically the sense that the city is sort of very connected to its literary history as well as dramatic history and the play, the political history. Of course, the book's a very political book, and if we knew more about Irish political history and its details, we probably could have said more about that in the podcast. But certainly the political history of Dublin is part and parcel of everything in its architecture, its statues, its buildings. We certainly had a lot of interesting political discussions while we were there with people. And we also went to the bar and we went on a literary pub crawl, and one of the bars that we stopped at is the bar that Bloom goes into. What were your thoughts about being there? Did you have any thoughts? As our fourth bar, although we're not heavy drinkers, do believe we at least shared a beer at each bar.
It was a very fun evening. It was led by two actors who did, among other things, scenes from Waiting for Godot, scenes from The Risen People, which was a play I did not know about, which was about the labor uprisings of the 19th century.
By the way, in Ireland, it's Got It.
All right, well.
Waiting for Got It.
Exactly. And being in the places wasn't as meaningful to me as it was just listening to these actors who were so steeped in this literary tradition. And
fantastic. Reading a lot of a letter by Oscar Wilde reporting supposedly his experience of drinking with Colorado miners in the bottom of a mine. Yeah. And being the only one who gets out sober and ends up rescuing all of them who are trying to get him drunk. Yeah. Because they don't like him.
I feel like I'm not answering your question, but something you said here just now clicked in my head. You were talking about the politics of the novel. This book was written between 1914 and 1921, which is a very important time in Irish independence. This was being written right before the Easter Uprising and during the Easter Uprising of 1916, which eventually led to the Irish Free State being declared in 1922. None of that gets mentioned in this book. You know, there's a lot of mention of the last century's attempts at Irish home rule. It's interesting to me in some ways that this book doesn't deal with the contemporary events.
Yeah, but he has that character, right, in the bar,
right,
who attacks Leopold Bloom, who's like really in favor of the Irish Free State, who's like a kind of more negative portrayal of a politician. But then you have some other politicians. I mean, there's at least in the annotated guide as we're reading along, there are constantly allusions being made to particular political figures and locations that were significant to that political history.
Right. But the other thing that was interesting to me about the Irish Writers Museum was in the section on Joyce, they pointed out Joyce made a big show out of rejecting both his Irish heritage and his Catholic heritage. He considered himself to be a writer for the world, and he actually wrote this book mostly in Paris and Zurich, and he never came back
to Ireland.
But of course, if you read this book, it's nothing but Catholicism and Irishness. It's like the idea, it's laughable for him to say that he's rejecting these things because it's so seeped into every page of this book.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That is a surprising claim that I read. I was very surprised by that claim in the museum, having read the book, and then to see that said as well. It's also very interesting that he writes this in a process of self-exile, because he, he says he's trying to situate himself outside of Ireland, and yet it takes place entirely in Ireland. So, you think you can leave, but you can never leave.
Right.
You can never leave home, you know.
Right.
You can never really leave home. It was interesting, for sure, to walk around Dublin and to connect with some of these sites. I think I was most struck by the ways in which the literary history of the city is just so steeped into its architecture, art, culture, and just sort of formed part of the landscape, not just the tourist landscape, which of course is what we mostly participated in, but also just the architecture of walking around the city. I don't think there's anything comparable to that in Boston or New York, actually. You know, we certainly see statues of particular important political figures and political moments, but I don't think we have the same engagement with public art and buildings and bars named after literary figures from Boston. I can't think of where there's a Nathaniel Hawthorne statue or anything equivalent. So.
There is one Edgar Allan Poe statue.
Which I know the designer of.
Oh, yeah?
Very good. Steph Rocknick, who is a fantastic sculptor, who went to graduate school with me at Boston University, is the sculptor of that Poe statue, and a very talented woman. She entered a competition and that's recent, but that was commissioned by people related to Boston College. So who care about literary things? So, it's a public work, but
right.
It's,
sure.
Let me just ask you a sort of fun question for our listeners. What did you most enjoy about the experience of being in Ireland?
One of the main reasons we went to Ireland is because both you and I have a great fondness for Celtic music, and we went there with the expectation of going to see music played in pubs. But one of the things that I found absolutely charming was music is all throughout the culture there. We went to a very small island called Inishere, which is one of the Aran Islands, and our guide there saying as he took us around the island, people were singing on the buses.
So I thought you were going to mention Inishere, the fact that the museum tour guide also turns out to have sung at like Carnegie Hall in Washington, D.C. to a silent film that was filmed in Ireland. He's a professional singer also. So this guy who's like sort of working the front desk and putting out coffee at this tiny little museum that we explored. We ended up talking to him and I said, what do you do? And he was like, oh, I'm a singer, and told us his story. At our Airbnb in Galway, I asked the gentleman who's hosting us, Kenneth, oh, by the way, what do you do for a living? And he said, I'm a singer. So it did seem like there's a very high number of, just like, I guess in Iceland, they have the highest per capita of Nobel winning authors for the literary prize. I have a feeling that in Ireland there are far more people who are musical and literary vis-a-vis your average.
And this connected to me because of the fact that Molly is a singer in the book, and she is, we discussed, you and I, whether or not she was a professional singer or whether she was an amateur singer. I think that ultimately one of the things that, that being in Ireland proved to me is that those distinctions aren't as meaningful to Irish people. A lot of people sing, a lot of people form bands and perform in pubs, and so you're as professional as whether you're getting paid to do it that night, I guess. So so that was charming to me. It made me think both of Molly. It made me think of Leopold, who is constantly thinking about things in terms of songs and arias and things. It's a land that's steeped in aesthetics, from the very urbane aesthetics of Dublin to the more more rural and what you might see as more solidly Irish traditions of the West Coast that we went to. But everywhere you go, people just people take delight in music and song and dance. There was we didn't get to see any, but we were told when we went to one of these pubs, oh, you need to come back because this dancer was there in the pub earlier that week. And I find that fascinating because how many bars in America would you go to and to go see dancers?
Yeah, it was actually at the Dingle Pub in Dingle, right. Which is not a particularly huge city. There's a world-renowned international dancer who dances. He owns the pub,
right.
Also. So that's how you can make a career as a musician, is if you also own a pub. So.
And what did you think? What was your favorite part?
Good question. I think I really admired the natural beauty of Ireland the most. I think anywhere I go, those are the things I come away most in admiration of, is the ocean, the rocks, I really appreciated the incredible kindness and generosity of the people that we met ordinarily. Just a real willingness to engage and help out wherever we were. If we had questions about anything, people were just incredibly helpful. But I think just the natural beauty of the place. We went, and probably the only period in Irish history ever where it didn't rain for 10 days. It just never rained when we were there. So it was an absolutely brilliant, beautiful landscape, and we got to enjoy every bit of it. So, and to the natural beauty of the place, I can say yes and yes and yes.
Thanks again to my co-host, Dr. Marina McCoy. Her most recent book is Wounded Heroes, Vulnerability as Virtue in Ancient Greek Literature and Philosophy. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can join the discussion on the Facebook page, or you can join the discussion on the membership Slack. If you'd like to write me directly, you may do so at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And as always, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.